Welcome to the Shortwave Report. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. This Shortwave Report is a 30-minute review of news and opinion heard on the shortwave radio and the internet in Northern California. Listening to international broadcast at home is quite easy. You just need a shortwave radio with a schedule of English language broadcast or a computer or smartphone with an internet connection. To help you with this, I'll announce times, frequencies, and website addresses at the conclusion of each series of stories. At the website for this show, that's www.outfarpress.com, you can listen to the past 5 shortwave reports, find advice for listening to shortwave at home, and find internet links for global news sources. Please check it out and tell a friend. In today's edition, you'll hear reports from Sputnik Radio, Radio Havana Cuba, NHK Japan, and Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. We'll begin with Sputnik Radio. On his program called Going Underground, Afshin Ratansi interviewed Alexander Zevin, author of Liberalism at Large, The World According to The Economist. He exposes the British magazine The Economist's deep involvement in promoting free trade and the laissez-faire disaster in Ireland during the Irish famine, pushing Western foreign policy goals such as the Pinochet coup in Chile and the coup in Iran in 1953 to U.S.-backed regime change operations in Venezuela today. Sputnik Radio.
In the past few days, Venezuela summoned Boris Johnson's top diplomat there for a dressing down of a UK, let alone EU, and US coup attempts. One magazine that this month's failed US mercenaries could have expected support from is the London-based Economist magazine, owned by European oligarchic interests like Rothschild, Cadbury, and the Fiat car family. Founded almost 200 years ago when it promoted market forces as a solution to the Irish potato famine that killed up to a quarter of the country's population, it has since championed imperialist death squad-backed regime change all over the world. It has even used alleged war criminal Henry Kissinger for its adverts. Joining me now from New York is Alexander Zevin, historian, New Left Review editor, and author of Liberalism at Large, The World According to The Economist. A year ago, The Economist magazine's leader was called How to Get Rid of Nicolás Maduro, an attempt to depose the dictator appears to have failed. Try again. What is this obsession with regime change, arguably, that you detail in the book?
I try to historicize the Economist's interest in promoting regime change around the world as being quite fundamental to the history of liberalism from the perspective of the magazine based in London. And to take just the period of the High Cold War, the Economist is, you know, trying to figure out what the best political systems are for the accumulation of capital for foreign investors, and really before Moody's, Standard & Poor's, or Barron's, or any of these other credit rating agencies ever exist, is negotiating and fine-tuning the mechanisms by which a society, a state, can be governed that are conducive to the kind of new financialized capitalism that we know so well. So that is as present in the coverage The Economist gives to the coup of Louis Napoleon in 1851 in France, and Marx writes about this in the 18th Brumaire. He says the Economist speaks as the European organ of the aristocracy of finance. You know, as the stock market rises, its confidence in the executive increases. And so I try to historicize it as a kind of phenomenon that goes beyond calls for regime change in Venezuela today, although, of course, the Economist continues to do that, but to really sort of see it as a structural phenomenon. And in the book, I cover the Economist's coverage of, you know, the coup in Brazil that deposes a democratic regime, in Guatemala, in Iran. It's not an isolated sort of obsession with Maduro. It's something that the Economist, from this perspective, has been talking about promoting openly for a very long time. And one of the things that I document in the book that isn't really well understood about the history of liberalism is just how central for the Economist laissez-faire economics was in the 1840s and early 1850s. And the Economist in that period adamantly opposes any form of intervention in the economy. And in terms of its relevance to our present crisis, that includes interventions to create modern plumbing, sewage, and a number of other pieces of social legislation, you know, there's a line that's pretty incredible from that period where the Economist says, there is worse evil than typhus or cholera or impure water, and that is mental imbecility. Today, the Economist has argued that the state should intervene in all sorts of ways to keep the economy going and to ensure some form of safety and sanitary standards. But that hasn't always been the case.
It may not be much in British school textbooks, but that was when maybe up to a quarter of the population of the island of Ireland were killed by the British black potato famine. I understand the Economist was equally laissez-faire about its solution to the arguable genocide in Ireland.
Precisely, and that is perhaps the most important episode in discussing and in talking about the practical effects of what laissez-faire meant. Laissez-faire was a policy that in Ireland led to over a million deaths. You know, the Economist ran leaders every week criticizing and attacking those who wanted to restrict trade out of Ireland. And in fact, it's important to realize that one of the reasons that free trade triumphed in Britain when it did was the argument that free trade would lead to a solution to the Irish famine. And so I think it's important to think about that today. If we simply, you know, continue on the path that we were on before the crisis began, it's no wonder that we see the kind of rampant inequalities exposed in our societies. The fact that in the U.S., where I'm based, those who go to work, who have to work, who can't work from home, are exposed to the virus in a way that people who stay at home aren't. You know, so certainly there are lessons in terms of what happens in a crisis when the market is allowed to simply determine who lives and who dies. In the book is a character named Robert Moss, who famously skipped down the corridors of the Economist's offices in 1973, the day that Salvador Allende in Chile took his life, chanting, "My enemy is dead." And Moss was deeply involved in the period leading up to that coup in preparing Western opinion, as well as within Chile. It was a sort of a clear-cut case of propagandizing, and Moss enjoyed ties to the CIA as well as to other Western intelligence agencies. And so what I try to demonstrate is that in the Cold War period in particular, we see those close connections to the state manifesting themselves in this kind of pushback against détente and against sort of not only left-wing or communist governments in the Third World, but even governments that simply attempted to sort of nationalize land.
Given that you itemize China, India, Afghanistan, Zululand, Sudan, South Africa, Malaya, Kenya, the kind of blood-soaked colonialism that it's promoted, why do you think today advertisers want to advertise in The Economist?
Well, I don't think they do know its past, and I don't think that everyone at The Economist really understands its past either. There's an idea that liberalism is inherently anti-imperial or anti-imperialist. Of course, this isn't the case, and I try to show the ways that the two phenomena are linked. For me, as an historian, the imperialism is not simply confined to the past. We live in a world in which relationships of colonial and neocolonial dependency, you know, continue to exist, to persist. And one of the things that I show in my book is that in order to construct the global economy, in order to construct global capitalism, one of the things that The Economist discovered when it had a terrible row with another group of liberals in the 1850s over these wars that arise, war in China, war in India, or the suppression of the Indian Mutiny, and the Crimean War, is that actually the management of the world economy, it requires actually the use of force and of violence. It's strange to me to imply that my book says anything other than that The Economist is extremely important. We ignore it at our peril. We should pay close attention to what The Economist says and advises, and sometimes we should do the opposite.
Alexander Zevin, thank you very much.
That interview was by Afshin Ratansi on Sputnik Radio, the current name for the Voice of Russia, available online at rt.com. Next, Radio Havana, Cuba. The Iranian tankers bringing gasoline and additives to Venezuela have been arriving despite U.S. military threats. Venezuela has rejected the U.S. intended sale of Citgo refineries in the U.S. based on asset seizures. Brazilian President Bolsonaro continues to attend rallies and greet people without a mask as the spread of and death toll from COVID-19 soars in his country. Trump has been discussing renewed nuclear bomb testing, the first since 1992. Israeli Prime Minister Netanyahu is facing corruption charges at a trial in Jerusalem. Then a viewpoint on the American dream, the land of opportunity, where Doctors Without Borders sent an emergency team to treat the indigenous Navajo members for COVID infections. Radio Havana, Cuba.
The Iranian vessel Petunia, with fuel and additives, arrived Tuesday in Venezuelan territorial waters, the third ship from Iran with fuel for Venezuela. The Iranian ships have the mission of supplying gasoline and gasoline additives to Venezuela, which is suffering from shortages due to the illegal sanctions imposed by the United States. A total of five Iranian fuel tankers are supplying Venezuela with gasoline. The Faxon, the Clavel, will soon arrive in Venezuela. The other two that are on their way, transporting 1.5 million barrels of gasoline. The second vessel, Forest, arrived in Venezuela on Monday, where it was destined to reach the El Palito refinery after crossing the northern zone of Margarita Island in Venezuelan waters. The other two fuel tankers are expected to arrive in Venezuelan waters between today, Wednesday, and Monday, June the 1st. The ships will be escorted by the Venezuelan armed forces in response to threats to intervene from the United States. Venezuela's government has rejected the intended sale of U.S.-based Citgo refineries, a subsidiary of Venezuelan state-run oil firm PDVSA, calling it an act of modern piracy. Venezuela denounces the decision of the District Court of Delaware regarding the judicial sale of the shares of Citgo, owned by Venezuela, after carrying out an act of modern piracy through a process that lacks legitimacy, the Ministry of Foreign Affairs mentioned in a tweet on Monday. U.S. Judge Leonard Stark approved moving forward with the Venezuelan opposition that has been conducting this illegal campaign to confiscate the Venezuelan public's wealth and assets. For such purposes, they have delegated to opposition leader Juan Guaido and his accomplices collecting $1.4 billion, that's billion with a B, dollars from a decade-owned dispute in the South American nation. It is illegal, acts to the detriment of national interest, and to the benefit of interventionist intentions, according to Jorge Arriaza, the Venezuelan foreign minister, who said that Citgo's illegal seizure and sale was against international law and an act of modern piracy. Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro has hit the streets for a rally with his supporters, ditching his face mask and breaking social distancing measures even as coronavirus cases surged out of control in Brazil. The Brazilian president arrived at the rally outside the presidential palace in Brasilia in a white surgical mask, but then took it off to greet a cheering crowd, shake hands, and embrace supporters. The rally came as Brazil emerged as a new flashpoint in the pandemic. With nearly 350,000 confirmed cases, Brazil now has the second biggest caseload in the world after the United States. It has registered more than 22,000 deaths. Brazilian President Bolsonaro has now famously compared the virus to a little flu. He argues that stay-at-home measures are unnecessarily hurting the economy. The Washington Post is reporting that the Donald Trump administration recently discussed conducting the first U.S. nuclear test explosion since 1992. One official told the newspaper that the test could help the United States in nuclear negotiations with China and Russia. But Daryl Kimball of the Arms Control Association warned that the move would be the starting gun to an unprecedented nuclear arms race. Benjamin Netanyahu, flanked by aides and officials wearing face masks to prevent coronavirus infection, said he was standing tall with his head held high and would continue to lead the country. Netanyahu is the first serving Israeli prime minister to face criminal charges as his trial opens in Jerusalem. Hundreds of people took part in rival protests in favor and against Netanyahu shortly before his appearance at the court on Sunday. The Israeli prime minister has been charged with fraud, breach of trust, and accepting bribes in a series of cases. He is accused of accepting expensive gifts such as cartons of champagne and cigars from wealthy friends, offering favors to media moguls in exchange for favorable news coverage of him and his family. In the most serious case, he is accused of promoting legislation that delivered hundreds of millions of dollars of profits to the owner of a major telecom company, while he had behind-the-scenes editorial influence over the firm's popular news website.
The United States of America is a nation that enjoys to live on dreams, metaphors, and the illusions created by movie scripts, television, or yellow press that uses catchy phrases like the American dream or the land of opportunities, which usually have nothing to do with reality. In a previous comment, it was explained the difficult situation of the indigenous peoples originating in the American territory. We recently received the news that for the first time in history, the humanitarian organization Doctors Without Borders sent an emergency team to the Navajo Nation to contain the disease, because the administration of the richest country in the world declared that they are unable to do anything to help these people. According to former Secretary of Labor Robert Reich, Natives, Latin Americans, and African Americans are dying from COVID-19 at a very high rate, and most alarming, superior to white peoples. But misery and poverty figures in the United States are not only a direct result of the pandemic. The disease just revealed the existing problems. Before the health crisis, 43 million people lived below the poverty line. An average of 300 evictions are carried out every day because they have a few weeks' delay in the payment of the rent, which is becoming more expensive while salaries continue the same. A documentary by the German agency Deutsche Welle reveals that 1.5 million of children live on the streets and 28 million Americans don't have health insurance, so they have to go to charity places for help. It's valid to wonder if a significant part of this amount of people ask themselves at night before going to sleep where their opportunities are in the dreamland.
Those reports and viewpoint were from Radio Havana, Cuba. Cuba's web stream worked well this week at their website, radiohc.cu, and their podcast links are fixed and working great. On shortwave, Cuba may be heard from noon to 1 p.m. at 15140, and from 6 p.m. to midnight at either 6000, 6060, 6100, or 6165. All the times I announce are for Pacific Daylight Saving Time, so please adjust them to your time zone. Next, NHK Japan. The National People's Congress of China is imposing new security laws on Hong Kong, resulting in a renewed uprising with threats coming from the United States. Japan is bracing for a second wave of COVID cases after lifting its state of emergency. NHK Japan.
China's National People's Congress is set to approve on Thursday a plan to impose new national security laws on Hong Kong. The step has unleashed a fresh wave of protests in the territory and a sharp rebuke from the United States, casting a question mark over the global financial hub's future. Last week's announcement of the security proposal triggered the first large-scale independence demonstrations in Hong Kong since the coronavirus crisis.
Now is the time for Beijing to realize that if they hope to burn and even erode the uniqueness of Hong Kong, they will face lots of backfire, not only from Hong Kong local community, but even in the global community.
Hong Kong police reportedly arrested more than 300 people. Police barricaded roads around the Legislative Council to keep demonstrators away. Chinese officials say Beijing will take the lead to establish laws to safeguard Hong Kong's security. While specifics of the bill remain unclear, it could see Chinese intelligence agencies set up in the territory. The law would aim to tackle any acts that endanger national security from terrorism to secession. That's led to concerns in Hong Kong that the territory's autonomy may be undermined. The one country, two systems principle was a key element in the handing over of Hong Kong from Britain in 1997. On Wednesday, U.S. Secretary of State Mike Pompeo said in a statement, "No reasonable person can assert today that Hong Kong maintains a high degree of autonomy from China given facts on the ground." The U.S. gives preferential treatment to the territory in tariffs and visa issuances. Pompeo said Hong Kong no longer warrants that special treatment. It's now up to the president to decide to end or suspend some or all of those benefits. Donald Trump said earlier he is preparing to respond to Beijing's plan later this week. The top U.S. diplomat for East Asia said Wednesday visa and economic sanctions are possible options for Trump. Japan is bracing for a second wave of coronavirus infections after its state of emergency was lifted. The government has sent a cluster response team to a western city reporting new cases whose infection routes are mostly unclear. Officials in Kitakyushu said on Wednesday they confirmed 22 cases in 5 days after not seeing any for over 3 weeks.
We're seeing cases from everywhere in the city. Please refrain from unnecessary outings.
Tourist spots and other facilities in the city had reopened but close again from Thursday. Japan has confirmed almost 16,700 cases of the virus and nearly 870 deaths. On Wednesday, 35 new cases were reported nationwide. In Osaka Prefecture, a man in his 80s tested positive for the third time. Meanwhile, the cabinet approved a second supplementary draft budget for the current fiscal year. It will help finance an emergency package worth about 117 trillion yen or around $1 trillion. The draft budget increases subsidies to help employers retain staff and will assist struggling firms by covering two-thirds of their rent for 6 months. The extra budget also addresses urgent needs in the health care sector. Workers in the industry will get cash handouts of up to 200,000 yen or about $1,800. Funds are also earmarked for developing drugs and vaccines.
Those reports were from NHK Radio Japan. They've altered their schedule and format and are now heard from 9:30 to 10 p.m. at 5975-7245 and 11970, or on the web at www.3.nhk.or.jp. If you have questions or comments about the shortwave report or could make a donation for production cost of this unfunded program, I may be reached through the website and PayPal, or by writing to Dan Roberts at P.O. Box 1162, Willits, California, 95490. Almost all the funding this freely distributed program receives is from individual listener donations. Please, if you find this program beneficial, help me keep it going. We will conclude with Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle. First, some brief reports on the pandemic around the world, including Thailand, India, Spain, and Brazil. Then a piece about the pandemic in the U.S. with comments from U.S. scholar Noam Chomsky, Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle.
The number of people who've died of COVID-19 has passed 350,000, according to Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. The United States counts for about a third of those deaths. Thailand has extended its state of emergency laws for another month until the end of June. The government says the laws are still needed as the country gradually eases restrictions. India's top biomedical research body has backed the use of the antimalarial hydrochloroquine as a treatment for coronavirus. This comes after the WHO suspended its trial of the drug, citing safety concerns. And Spain has begun a period of national mourning in honor of the victims of COVID-19. For 10 days, flags will be hoisted at half-mast in public buildings across the country. Now, the U.S. has pushed forward a travel ban on Brazil by 2 days, meaning it will come into force on Wednesday. The travel ban is being seen as a blow to right-wing Brazilian President Jair Bolsonaro, who has been downplaying the virus and pushing for lockdown measures to be lifted. But the pandemic is gaining speed in South America's largest country. Brazil's most recent single-day death toll overtook that of the U.S., with 807 deaths compared to 620 in the U.S. Brazil is now the country with the second highest number of cases globally, more than 370,000. That's still significantly fewer than the U.S., which has more than 1.6 million cases. Deaths from COVID-19 in Brazil number more than 23,000.
The United States has more confirmed coronavirus cases than any other country in the world, with almost 1.7 million. It's also on the verge of marking another grim milestone as the number of deaths approaches 100,000. U.S. President Donald Trump has been criticized for reacting too slowly to the pandemic. Some say fatalities could have been reduced if he had taken a different course of action.
Taking the new normal to a new level. Churches are closed in the New York borough of Queens, but that didn't stop these Catholic priests from tending to their flock outside. Many are in need of solace. COVID-19 has exacted a devastating toll in New York. Nearly a quarter of all deaths in the U.S. so far have been recorded in the state. That's nearly 25,000 people, more than eight times the number killed on 9/11. It didn't need to be this way, says veteran scholar Noam Chomsky. He blames Donald Trump for the catastrophe.
There's no coherent leadership. It's chaotic. The presidency, the White House, is in the hands of a sociopathic megalomaniac who's interested in nothing but his own power.
Unsurprisingly, Trump, seen here playing golf on Sunday, has a different take on the situation. He insists the country is out of the woods and says it's time to move on and open up. All 50 states have begun lifting their lockdowns, a relief for many, especially during the holiday weekend. Each state is easing restrictions at its own pace, but concerns are growing that some governors are pushing to open up too quickly because of the need to rescue the economy. This is fueling fears of a second wave of infections.
You know, I'm glad it's cold, because you know what? Ready? We don't need this kind of big weekends. Keep away. It's too many people. They can't afford that thing now. Usually, if it was a nice weather, regular, normal time, you can have millions of people. You don't want that.
Many in the U.S. may be happy to be getting back to normal, but the virus has not gone away. And experts fear this could translate into more infections and more deaths.
Those reports were from Germany's Radio Deutsche Welle, which may be heard at a combined audio-video website, dw.com. Deutsche Welle is producing excellent virus reports daily in English, which you can easily find at dw.com. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people like you to listen to international broadcasts, get a global perspective. You could use a shortwave radio at home. It's simpler than you might think, except for the interference that your electronic devices will cause. If you use the internet, listening globally is easier and noise-free. See the links at this program's website. Every Thursday evening, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows. Please consider making a safe donation online through PayPal. There's a link at my website along with the podcast link, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report, which is now in its 24th year of production, remains free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.